Good afternoon. This is Steve Hopcraft on behalf of Restore the Delta and Californians for a Fair Water Policy. Thank you so much for joining our briefing by experts in advance of Monday's release of the specific project proposal EIR, EIS documents by Governor Brown. We've been waiting for a long time to see exactly what the administration would propose, and we understand that it is going to be very much like the flawed proposals that we have seen over the past year. Today, we're going to present experts who will give you piercing insights into what to look for in these 30,000 pages that will officially be released this coming Monday. And, of course, poring over those 30,000 pages while on deadline is difficult. We have Dr. Jeffrey Michael, as you know, who is with the Business Forecasting Center at the University of the Pacific. He will be our first speaker. And Dr. Michael, of course, has been analyzing this for over a year now and has criticized the lack of a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis. He will give you his key points to look for. Dr. Michael.
Thank you, Steve. Just like to point out for the water agencies that are pushing this, since the BDCP process started back in 2006 and 2007, the construction cost estimates of the tunnels have increased from $4 billion to $15 billion, nearly a factor of four. The cost of the planning process, the states just asked for another $1.2 billion just to complete planning and design over the next 3 years. That was supposed to cost $150 million. The total cost of planning is now up to $1.5 billion, a factor of 10. Through the planning process, we now know that the water supply benefits have dwindled from the tunnels, the environmental benefits aren't what they were touted, and the seismic risk benefits are almost nothing. Seismic levee improvements have been shown to provide a broader range of economic benefits for the tunnels for a fraction of the cost. So it's evident to most people looking at this independently at this point that the tunnels don't make any economic, financial, or environmental sense for California. At this point, the beneficiaries of the tunnels seem to be the water agencies and political leaders who want to finish their legacies, and the consulting and construction firms that are profiting from the ever-spiraling costs. Really, the only way to finance the colossal debt service of the Delta Tunnels is going to be to keep Southern California and Silicon Valley dependent on Delta water for the next 50 years or more. Financing the tunnels is going to require long-term contracts and assurances for water exports that lock in unsustainably high-level water exports for decades. And it will reduce water security for communities that are in and upstream from the Delta in a world of climate change. Most important, when BDCP releases its new documents, you'll find that after 7 years, it still has no financial plan whatsoever, no allocation of costs between the water agencies that have vowed to pay for it. Agriculture is the problem. Agriculture is supposed to pay the majority of the tunnel costs because they receive the majority of the water. But it's financially untenable for them. The cost of water through these tunnels to grow an acre crops is going to far exceed the income it produces. And there's some numbers from this in the past week or two that shed some light in this. Citigroup was made a presentation to Westlands about bond financing for the project a week or two ago. In the presentation, the tunnel proponents estimated the debt service for construction of the tunnels would be between $1.25 billion and $2 billion per year. Add to that another $100 million for the debt on the financing costs, which is borrowed money also, and $50 million a year for operating costs, and the contractors have a total annual bill of $1.4 billion to $2.2 billion per year when the tunnels are operating. Agriculture is supposed to pay 60% of the cost for 60% of the water. 60% of that total is $800 million to $1.3 billion per year. That's a pretty hefty total for agriculture to pay to water crops. In fact, what are the benefits of those growers? According to the BDCP's own economic studies, building the tunnels are predicted to increase agricultural revenue for San Joaquin Valley growers by $134 million per year. That's gross revenue, not net revenue or profit, which will be less than half that total. So agriculture's share of the tunnel costs, about $1 billion a year, is more than 10 times the less than $100 million in value they will receive from them. It's insanity for farmers to engage in this, and it creates a giant hole in the financial plan that, as a scale of the size of the project, is at least as large as the financial hole in the high-speed rail plan. Making the math work shows that it's going to require a large subsidy from urban ratepayers or taxpayers to the agricultural users. It just won't work any other way. And if they say that that's not going to happen, then they have to produce an honest presentation that shows how this is in the interest of farmers and how they can possibly pay their share of the cost by growing crops. I'd like to point out that BDCP is a conservation plan. It's not just the tunnels. It has a lot of worthy environmental projects associated with it, things like enhanced flood bypasses that provide fish rearing habitat. But the financing for those environmental elements doesn't come from the contractors. It doesn't depend on the tunnels. They have separate financing. A habitat conservation plan to comply with the ESA doesn't require the tunnels at all. So California needs a cost-effective conservation plan that doesn't have the tunnels. My last point, I'm going to talk about the earthquake risk. You know, for several years, the main argument for building the tunnels has been protection from an earthquake-induced mass levee failure in the Delta that would salt it up and spoil water exports. Now, to the credit of state officials, many of them have been backing away from this bogus argument in the past year, as their own analysis shows limited seismic benefits from the tunnels. However, the PR machine continues to push the disaster scenario, I guess because you know, the media loves disaster scenarios. So I'm going to address this argument quickly. The earthquake argument for the tunnels is both economically and morally wrong. The state's own risk assessment of this low probability disaster scenario shows that 80% of the economic loss and 100% of the hundreds of lives lost in such a catastrophic flood have nothing to do with water exports at all. Most of that's right in the Delta communities itself. So if the risk is as great as the state claims, then seismic upgrades to the levee system are both an economic and moral imperative to protect the public safety and all economic values, including those of the water exporters. The state should not be exploiting the human tragedies of Katrina and Sandy the way they have in much of their press work to justify tens of billions of dollars on water tunnels that do nothing to protect lives or property from catastrophic floods. So that's the end of my comments. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Michael. Again, we will have three more brief expert presentations, and then we will take your questions. You just need to press star one if you want to get in the queue to ask a question of any of the experts once they are all done. Of course, this project is being sold as being necessary to provide water supply that is reliable for Southern California and other urban areas, but as Dr. Michael has pointed out, they will be getting no new water and paying the lion's share of the cost to subsidize water for mega growers in Westlands and Kern. Connor Everts is the executive director of the Southern California Watershed Alliance and has been working for sustainable local water independence for many, many years. We would like Connor now to outline for us how he views this. Is this a good deal for Southern California businesses and households? What will this mean, Connor?
Well, it'll mean when Southern California really peaked in its water demand in 1992, and ever since we've become more efficient. I know that'd be hard to tell people in Northern California, but it's true. And so if what we do is create a diversion from that work that we've done, and we're kind of at that crossroads with a lot of agencies. Do we reinvest in our local infrastructure? And a good example is the big aquifer in the San Fernando Valley. And do we continue to enhance it with our stormwater programs and even the local water programs that have provided economic development and jobs for our community groups and others? We have economic studies that show the level of efficiency and investment and how valuable that is. We need to make use of that now. But there's only so much money available, and if the agencies who are kind of deciding which way to go on this, kind of the hard path of supply of the last century or the soft path of appropriate technology and doing local programs, then we won't get there. So we're really urging to continue on the path we've already taken. We've got agencies in San Diego that are down 30 to 40%. Los Angeles is down around 19% right now. Our per capita has dropped across the region. And legally, we're all required to drop 20% by 2020. Long-range plans for places like the City of Los Angeles, Department of Water and Power's Urban Water Management Plan, by the year 2035, we'll have 37% less reliance on imported water. In Santa Monica, where I live, we're actually going for independence of imported water by 2020. We have groundwater, so we can do that. We've cleaned up our groundwater. We're enhancing our other programs. It's hard to imagine. I would say from San Francisco, you know, we can't tell them we do more, but actually we have done more on a per capita basis. We want to continue to do more. But to do that, we have to invest properly locally. And I think a lot of businesses and other agencies, when they understand the real meaning of the word reliable, and that comes from local investment, not from faraway investments and infrastructure that we really don't understand. You know, we had huge Maine explodes in the San Fernando Valley on Mulholland Boulevard and other places. We have 7,200 miles of infrastructure and pipes just in the city of Los Angeles, and we have a 100-year program to replace them. We could certainly step that up, and we are beginning to do that. And I think lastly is the economic development and the jobs issue. If we're just importing jobs to the north by doing this instead of providing local jobs, then we're really missing the long-term opportunity here. So I think we do what we've always done. While we talk about these issues, and even in the best opportunity to be 20 years before it was built, we will continue to reduce demand. And prices have already gone up 70% over the last 7 years for the Metropolitan Water District, the master wholesaler. And because of that, also people are dropping their demand and their usages and finding ways as simple as cisterns. The library in Santa Monica recovers almost 200,000 gallons. Tree people, 160,000 gallons. That provides all their landscaping needs for the rest of the year. There are a lot of local solutions you wouldn't think about, but are certainly happening across Southern California. That's what I have, and I'd be happy to take questions later.
Thank you, Connor. Again, our case against this project is on multiple levels, including that it is the wrong solution. It is not a sustainable water resources management plan. It is the plan from the past. And as Connor outlined, we need regional water independence that invests not in massive tunnels to carry water that won't exist in the future, but that invests in local solutions that is sustainable for the long term. There are also multiple legal problems with this project, the way it is currently proposed. And Bob Wright is the senior counsel for Friends of the River, one of the lead litigants who has already noticed the federal and state government that this proposal does not comply with the law. Bob?
Yeah, I'd like to make three points as briefly as possible. First, the BDCP water tunnels are a fraud on the public and against the law. It's that simple. Second, the federal and state agencies are committing flagrant procedural violations of environmental laws that will leave the public totally in the dark as the public tries to deal with the 30,000 or so pages of bias and advocacy that the consultants will be releasing on behalf of the water tunnels next week. Third, there is a very good alternative that the state ignores. Turning to that first point, government agencies calling the BDCP water tunnels part of a conservation plan is a fraud on the public. The plan is to grab the water and in the process take it away from designated critical habitat for several already endangered and threatened species of fish, including Sacramento River Winter Run and Central Valley Spring Run Chinook salmon, and drive them into extinction. That is against the law because federal agencies are prohibited from doing that by the Endangered Species Act. There's always a big lie under every fraud. The big lie under this fraud by the state is the claim that taking more water helps the fish. That's ridiculous. That hurts the fish. The fish need more water, not less water. On-the-ground habitat does not help the fish. The fish do not have feet. They do not have legs. They live in the water. Second, I mentioned the procedural violations. The federal agencies have failed to prepare the required written biological assessments and biological opinions addressing the effect of the water tunnels on the fish species and their designated critical habitat. The idea is that the public is supposed to have that information while reviewing the BDCP draft EIR EIS coming out next week. This omission is deliberate. It is intentional. We've been calling this to the attention both in writing and orally to the federal agencies since last June. That is a flagrant violation of the National Environmental Policy Act command that, and I'm quoting, to the fullest extent possible, agencies shall prepare draft environmental impact statements concurrently with and integrated with environmental impact analyses and related surveys required by the Endangered Species Act. So in these 30,000 or so pages of bias and advocacy from the consultants representing the special interests that want the water tunnels, here's what's going to happen over the next 4 months of the review period. The public will have what it does not need, unsupported advocacy from the consultants speculating that adverse effects will be offset. The public will not have what it does need, the federal agency biological assessments and biological opinions required by the Endangered Species Act. The 30,000 pages being released next week are not worth the paper they're printed on. They're not worth the space they're going to take up on people's computers. They're absolutely worthless from the standpoint of informed public review of this project. And that's classically what's done in the case of every fraud, whether it's carried out by private swindlers or government agencies. You conceal, you hide, you put out a bunch of nonsense, and you keep the victims in the dark. And that's what's being done here. Third, there is a good alternative. The conservation option would be to reduce exports, not build the water tunnels, focus on water conservation and recycling, and increase flows for the fish and the delta. No tunnels. I'd be happy to take any questions after the last presentation.
Thank you, Bob. Again, it is striking that you propose a conservation plan, and the first and principal conservation measure is to build these massive water export tunnels to take them, as Bob says, around the area or under the area that you are intending supposedly to conserve. Our final expert is Barbara Barragan-Perea, Executive Director of Restore the Delta. And, of course, Restore the Delta, the coalition of everyone in the Delta, fishermen, farmers, environmentalists, governments, developers, everyone who is at, as we say, ground zero. Barbara will address not only how this will impact the fisheries in the Delta that also, of course, feed the Pacific fisheries and the Bay Area fisheries, but also how it will impact the Delta itself and, again, some of the other elements of our better solution. Barbara?
Thank you, Stephen. Good afternoon. In addition to no financing plan, no cost-benefit analysis, skirting around environmental laws, we also know that the final release of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and its companion EIR will also not include accurate, true, and full operational criteria for the proposed tunnels. The Westlands Water District and the Kern County Water Agency receive more water each year than the Metropolitan Water District and the Santa Clara Valley Water District combined, and that's with their millions of residents. But yet, the Santa Clara Valley Water District and the Metropolitan Water District, their ratepayers are the people who are going to be asked to subsidize this project. The big agribusiness growers, on the other hand, that can be found in the Westlands Water District and the Kern County Water Agency, contribute less than 0.3% to the state's GDP. Westlands is growing almonds to ship to China on drainage-impaired lands, and billionaire farmer Stuart Resnick is growing pistachios on taxpayer and ratepayer subsidized water, all to the detriment of Bay and Delta fisheries, Delta family farms, Delta area cities, and the San Francisco Bay. And that's something that hasn't been talked about a lot. In fact, just a few weeks ago, Friends of the San Francisco Bay Estuary published letters indicating that the impacts of the tunnels project on San Francisco Bay fisheries and the Bay's ecosystem have not been properly analyzed in these documents. The construction of the tunnels will dewater the Sacramento River, turning historic Delta communities basically into a war zone and eliminating important habitat for greater sandhill cranes. And, of course, once operation of the project begins, the remaining farms and urban areas in the Delta will be greatly harmed by reduced freshwater flows. No river system or estuary has ever been improved by diverting the majority of water from itself. And remember, those twin tunnels may be initially installed with pumps to move 9,000 cubic feet per second of water, but they have been physically sized with a capacity to divert the entire Sacramento River. Dr. Jerry Merrill, the administration's lead on the BDCP, in his recent tour up and down the state, states that the tunnels will cost households in Southern California just as much as a cell phone bill. He and the water agency leaders pushing this boondoggle project ignore that many families in urban communities can't really afford a second monthly cell phone bill, especially without receiving any additional water, because people living in those water districts will not receive additional or new water from the project. So we have to ask ourselves, what is it that we are being asked to sacrifice for unsustainable agriculture in California? We're being asked to sacrifice the greatest estuary on the west coast of the Americas. We're being asked to sacrifice family farms that have been in existence for over 150 years. We're being asked to sacrifice the San Francisco Bay. We're being asked to sacrifice upstream rivers and the water supply for millions of Californians in one part of the state, not to help households in other parts of the state, but to continue shipping almonds and pistachios around the world. There's enough water to share with our neighbors in Southern California and the Santa Clara Valley, and we can do it in a much more cost-effective and sustainable manner than what is proposed in the BDCP. That concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And before we open it up to questions, again, if you would like to ask a question to one of our experts, please press star one on your phone. Before we do open it up, I just want to catch you up on a couple of the logistical details that we see coming over the next week. Again, Californians for Fair Water Policy has organized over 50 groups to oppose this boondoggle that will not solve our water resources challenge. And on Monday, when this official document becomes public, we are going to be protesting across the state. We will have a protest at the Santa Clara Valley Water District, where we understand Resources Secretary John Laird will try to persuade them to support this proposal. There will be a protest. There will be spokespersons there beginning at 9 a.m. at the Santa Clara Valley Water District. Connor himself will be in Los Angeles at the Metropolitan Water District, which will be considering this boondoggle as well. We will have a press conference and a rally in Sacramento at the state capitol, as well as a news teleconference at 3 p.m. on Monday, once our experts have had a chance to really go through, and you have had a chance to really go through these pages in detail, hopefully looking for some of the red flag items that we have identified in this call. We will have an advisory going out to you about those Monday events a little bit later this afternoon. So just before we open it up, today participating and cooperating agencies received the official proposed documents. On Monday, we understand that the Brown administration will release those and post them for public information. Next Friday, it will be published in the Federal Register, and we're off and running on the official countdown to the rejection of this ill-considered project. I'd like at this time to open it up to your questions. Again, if you have a question, I would like you to just press star 1, and we are going to take the first question now. Please address it to one of our experts, or if you just state the question in general, I will try to address it to our best expert. And yeah, go ahead.
This is Wilson Water News, sir. I'd like to ask your mom.
With having this, a hard time, Bert, here understanding you, Bert. There's a lot of noise on your line there.
Outflow figures in the 30 pages.
Okay, I'm sorry. Again, we have a lot of interference on your line. The question I hear is, where are we seeing the outflow figures on the 30,000 in the 30,000 pages? If you press star 4, it will increase the volume. Barbara, would you address that question?
Well, the needed outflows for the Bay Delta Estuary were actually analyzed at the end of 2011, and it was determined at that time across the board by fishery agencies and NGOs that more flow needed to pass through the Delta out through the San Francisco Bay to the ocean. Those flows will not be found in the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. That is work that will have to be continued by the State Water Resources Control Board, and that would become one of the fights or challenges to the BDCP later on. Bob might want to add something.
Bob, did you want to address that?
Yeah, I'm looking. I had a moment here to pull that up. The State Water Resources Control Board on August 3rd of 2010 actually developed their flow criteria, which was required by the California legislature under the Delta Reform Act. And the purpose of that flow criteria was to inform the planning decisions for the BDCP. And what the State Board came up with on August 3rd, 2010, was 75% of unimpaired delta outflow from January through June, 75% of unimpaired Sacramento River inflow from November through June, and 60% of unimpaired San Joaquin River inflow from February through June. Under that, of course, the delta tunnels is not a feasible alternative because it would not it would take too much water for those figures to be maintained. So what you have here is the state is ignoring the very criteria that the Delta Reform Act required the State Water Resources Control Board to develop that was supposed to guide the planning decision. So that's another thing, as well as the Endangered Species Act. The state agencies are quite happy to also be ignoring the requirements of the Delta Reform Act and the State Water Resources Control Board.
Thank you, Bob. Our next question comes from Paul Rogers of the San Jose Mercury News. Again, press star one if you'd like to ask a question of one of our experts. Paul?
I have two questions, actually. The first one is I'd like you guys have presented a lot of information here, and I'd like to sort of be able to focus on what you consider the top two or three questions that the public needs to know to make a good decision on this plan. And what I'm hearing so far is specifically how much money is each contractor agency going to put up? Second, how much water in millions of acre feet per year on average will be taken under this plan compared to what we're taking right now? And what other one or two or three, and please don't give me 10, key questions would you want the public to have the answer to?
Dr. Michael, could you begin with the response to that?
Yeah, I mean, you ask a really good question. How much will each agency be asked to put up? And you also need to ask, is that a cost that makes sense for those agencies? So, you know, they'll tell you a number. You're in San Jose, right? So they'll tell a number for Santa Clara Valley Water District that they can afford. But that's a number that assumes that the agricultural districts are actually going to pay the same cost per acre foot, and that's untenable. And so you really, in order to, you know, if you get a whatever number they give you, for it to be a believable number, you have to show that the number makes sense for all the contractors, and it doesn't. You shouldn't believe what they're telling you about the cost to the urban agencies.
I would like to add that about a year and a half ago, board members at the Santa Clara Valley Water District said that the monthly bills for their ratepayers would go up by 15%. All of a sudden today, they're saying that their contribution for the project, this is in their board packet for Monday, is $780 million total. And that's what the effect would be on Santa Clara ratepayers and property taxes. I think it would be important to ask them how they got to that number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other large macro statewide questions, though, like what we're talking about here about who is putting up how much and can they afford it? That seems like the obvious question. Second, how much water is actually being taken? And then, I mean, it seems to me a third one is, you as you pointed out, Barbara, a few minutes ago, the state and feds keep saying, well, there's only a certain capacity, you know, 9,000 CFS that we'll use. And I think one thing I've heard you ask over and over again is how can we be sure that once it's built, they won't open the faucet wider?
That's correct.
Yeah.
With guarantees.
And we did our August comment letter, this is Bob Wright, that nobody would spend additional billions of dollars to build larger tunnels unless there was an intent down the road to use that capacity. It just wouldn't be a sound economic move. But one other thing that definitely has to be, I think, at the top of the list is it's not just us talking about the endangered fish species. The National Marine Fisheries Service in April of 2012 and again in 2013 issued a red flag comment that the water tunnels threaten, and I'm quoting for you, the potential extirpation of main stem Sacramento River populations of winter run and spring run Chinook salmon over the term of the permit, close quote. Now, that's something that the Endangered Species Act prohibits. It's not just a procedural law. You just can't do that. And that's why I'm sure you've heard people say from time to time that various people in federal agencies are speaking candidly and honestly say, this is simply not a permittable project. And that's why what's going on right now, the missing information that's so critical is the biological assessments and biological opinions by the federal fishery agencies under the Endangered Species Act, because without that information, there's no basis there for the public to determine if this even looks like a permittable project. And if it's not a permittable project, it's not a reasonable alternative.
My second question actually has to do with folks who maybe aren't paying super close attention to this, but who see it just as a large public works project, kind of like the high-speed rail project or the Bay Bridge or one of these other large projects, and who might ask, you know, generations ago, California as a state used to build very large projects. Obviously, Jerry Brown's father built the hundreds of miles of highway, the state water project, the university system, and his son is having a hard time with both of his big projects. I'm curious what you would say to people who say, why can't we build large public works projects anymore like we used to?
Yeah. Well, I think what people see in California is they
I'm sorry, who's this talking?
This is Jeff Michael.
Jeff, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, what people see in their communities is their local public infrastructure falling apart all around them. And it's absolutely true that we need infrastructure investments in the state, and it will create jobs. But we talk about what we don't need are these giant mega projects with huge cost overruns that take 20 years to complete and don't provide benefits for decades. You know, technology might leapfrog these projects before they're ever online and built. What we need is local water projects that are ready to go now, from repairing pipes to all sorts of other projects that Connor was talking about, and investment in other local transportation infrastructure and the things that can be done quickly that people need now.
I hear you comparing it to high-speed rail.
Well, yeah, there are similarities. In fact, in my view, high-speed rail is a better project economically because it actually creates mobility. It creates transportation. This is a project where we've got water agencies though spending an enormous amount of money on projects that don't create new water, and it will be a direct substitute and prevent them from making investments in local water supplies that actually increase the water supply for the whole state. Things like recycling projects and repairing those leaky pipes, things that will provide much faster benefits and are lower costs and can be distributed across the state where they're needed.
Thank you.
The only thing I would like to add is that also in comparison on water projects, we have a changing climate. The big projects that were built a long time ago fit that time and that climate. As climate change accelerates, the chances for either too much water to be taken out of the system when there's limited water, or for those tunnels to end up completely dry because a severe drought will increase. And either way, you end up with an asset that's not going to deliver what we're being told it should deliver.
So it sounds like you guys aren't saying no big projects statewide should be built. It's just that the kinds that we're seeing from the Brown administration are not a good use of the money.
Well, this is Bob Wright. We're saying that as to the Delta water tunnels. And, again, I want to just get back a little bit to the difference between the water tunnels and high-speed rail. Is high-speed rail does not threaten to extinguish species. Now, of course, we have people who don't really – some people are kind of oblivious and don't really care about extinguishing species. But Congress made a judgment founded on moral and religious principles that it's morally wrong for federal agencies to take action that will extinguish species. You have to remember, once a species is extinguished, it's gone forever. That moral judgment and religious judgment was made in the enactment of the Endangered Species Act. And that is why many folks realize that the Delta water tunnels are not a lawfully permittable project, because they would, as the National Marine Fisheries Service says, cause the extirpation of several endangered species of fish. That is a judgment. I think it's a good judgment. I think it's a moral judgment. I think it's the kind of a judgment we make here in America, that it's important to protect endangered species, and that's what is the barrier to the a huge legal barrier to the Delta water tunnels. It is not a barrier to the high-speed rail.
Thank you. This is Connor Everts. I have to weigh in because you know, everyone thinks the end result of this is Southern California, but in terms of the high-speed rail, the parallel is, you know, the rail may never get out of the Central Valley at the point it's going now, and we don't expect most of this water to get out of the Central Valley as well. And what we've learned from the projects that were built in the 60s of large centralized projects to essentially create a plumbing solution is that we have to do the policy first. And the aftermath of those big water projects are really pushing us towards decentralization. And I was in Australia this May on an energy and water tour to compare how they use so little per capita and so efficiently. And one way they really have done that is decentralized and do local water programs, almost even down to a skyscraper, digging in and doing sewer mining and creating a water supply right there. But they've also changed their groundwater laws, and they've changed their water rights, and they've made those major transitions in light of climate change, and we haven't done that yet.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Our next question is from Lauren Summer with KQED. Lauren?
Hi there. You guys talked a little bit about other solutions or alternatives to BDCP. You mentioned restoration. You know, how much restoration would you want to see? Where would you want to see it? And then what would the solution be to the environmental impact of the South Delta pumps?
Barbara, could you lead the response? And then I think we would want to hear from Connor about the Southern California solutions as well.
Sure. In terms of in the Delta, we have opportunity for the couple hundred miles of Delta levees that need improvement to actually upgrade them to wide levees. It makes much more sense for fish populations to put habitat on the water side of wide levees for fish habitat restoration. And also, that habitat should be created by willing sellers or participants, not the threat of eminent domain where we're going to mark out a plan and take 140,000 acres and 25% of the landmass away from the Delta and Delta communities to put it where we think it needs to be put. It makes much more sense to reinforce the levees for flood protection, for water exports, and to protect people in the Delta and work that in with habitat. In terms of the pumps, at Tracy, you know, the BDCP, according to the document, explains that they will still be pumping in dry years, and they will be using those pumps about 51% of the time, even after construction of the tunnels. The pumps have to be reconfigured. They have to be properly screened, and that's something that can be done for $1.5 to $2 billion, and is something that has to be done. And it makes much more sense to reconfigure and use that technology. It may not be perfect, but it can be greatly improved than it does to build the tunnels and continue using those pumps half the time without any improvement.
So how many acres would you want to see of restoration? And then are these positive fish screens you're talking about in the South Delta pumps, or would you still actually be pumping?
You know, the fish screening technology would also include, from what I understand, reconfiguration of the forebay, and it's existing technology. So I'm not sure if you call them positive screens. You can find greater detail about the technology at the Environmental Water Caucus water plan, a sustainable water plan, which is on their website. And then getting back to the amount of acres, I don't see it as a commitment in acreage. I think it's something that has to be created by the community from the bottom up. The whole problem with the habitat conservation piece of this is that people came from the outside into our backyard and decided we're going to take this much land out of production. The way to do it and the way communities traditionally do it is you get people together within your community, you find willing sellers, and you create a strategy together. I think for us to figure out how much acreage that is and where it should be has to be divorced from the water export plan. And that has to happen first.
Connor, do you have any response to Lauren's question?
Sure. I think the missing link in California water, another one, I guess, is really restoring flows and offsetting by the conservation, and I'm talking a broad sense of that word, including large-scale reclamation. L.A. is at about 2% of what we can do. Orange County is a good example. But what we don't do is then return any of the water we've saved back to the environment. So I'm more interested in the flows and reducing the take the imported water down to 3 million acre feet and offsetting that with water we save. And the only good example I know of that is Mono Lake, where 30% of the water we saved in Los Angeles then was returned as freshwater flows into Mono Lake, and that took 20 years of litigation. We need to set those standards. The best thing that has happened to us in Southern California, and I lived in a small community where we were supposed to get a state water, Ojai, near Ventura and Santa Barbara, where we were supposed to get an allocation of state water project water. When we didn't, then we were forced to live within our means, and we started doing things, very radical things, like metering and monitoring farmers' wells and really knowing how much water we needed to use and how much we could. And that kind of change is where we have to go in this century, instead of the assumption that there will always be more and more water, when really this project has turned to that kind of promise to now we're going to be paying more for less.
Right. I mean, Lauren, I would also point out that the while it's hoped that the new North Delta intakes will be less harmful than the South Delta ones, they are still very harmful to the fish. And, the way to reduce the harm to the fish is to export less water over time.
That concludes the number of questions I see from the media. Again, star one will get you to the question line. I do see more questions coming up now. Again, we just want to point out to you that while this project by law is required to meet the, quote, co-equal goals of restoring the Delta and providing a reliable, sustainable water supply, we believe that the conservation plan is lip service, that there is not a true commitment, that they predetermined what project they wanted, these tunnels, and that they are driving and have been from day one driving to build these tunnels. We continue to ask the challenging question, how do you restore a freshwater estuary by taking millions of acre feet of water a year out of that estuary? We do not see how that possibly makes any sense. Our next question, I believe, did you have another question, Lauren, or can we move on? Okay. Lauren, did you get all your questions answered? Okay, Paul, I believe then that you are the next questioner.
Yeah, I just had one more, and that's sort of a political strategy tool. You've hinted at some of these, but I'm curious what your tools are after this comes out in stopping this project. Obviously, there are lawsuits under the ESA and NEPA. Are you guys considering other options, like putting it on a statewide ballot for a vote? Because as the state likes to point out, as the advocates of this project like to point out, it doesn't need to come up for any kind of a public vote. So what are the cards that you're likely to play as this moves forward to try to stop it?
Barbara, Bob, would you like to address that?
I'm going to talk about the public relations and outreach and education end. Our experience, particularly over the last 2 years, is that the more people learn about the project, the more they dislike it, and that is consistent in every part of California. We will continue, and we will be accelerating our public outreach and education campaign. And we work, and we are constantly bringing on new groups to support us in our effort to stop the project and to voice their opposition to the Brown administration. From there, after the public comment period, there are other processes that will evolve. Bob will talk about that, and, of course, litigation would pick up. If at the end that cannot stop it, would we then have to become different organizations and move into a different strategy? Yes. Because we are absolutely determined to fight this every which way to stop the project for the benefit of California and to save the Delta.
So that would include a statewide ballot measure if you still aren't able to block it?
If other means couldn't do it, and if that's where we had to go, yes, we would.
Okay.
I would add to that, in the very near term, they're out of money, and they need $1.2 billion to complete the planning process for this that they're asking the agencies for now, and a lot of the water agencies are having second thoughts about this. So there's no actual financial plan or commitment to it. So we could see water agencies falling out and walking away from this project very soon, just over these growing financial questions.
I assume you might also oppose a water bond, right? A state water bond that would be used to pay for part of this?
Any state water bond that has money to enable, assist, or underwrite these tunnels will face fierce opposition from our coalition. Bob, did you want to comment about litigation at all?
I will, although I think Paul already has it well in mind because he mentioned it in his question. But it's really a twofold process we're going through. One, we've been communicating with in writing, and we had a meeting in November with the federal agencies. We will continue to communicate with them. And what we're trying to do is get them to commit to doing the right thing, which is preparing the biological assessments and biological opinions under the Endangered Species Act, because if we believe that's done, that'll be the end of the project right there. It simply won't be permittable, and it won't be necessary to litigate. And on the other hand, if they go forward and approve the BDCP, then we will have some really fantastically strong legal issues to challenge them with in court.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, I have to weigh in again. This is
Connor.
Yeah, this is Connor again. You know, it's really water taxation without representation. And having had a mentor of Dorothy Green who worked in the 82 initiative, I certainly think we and the group I work with, Food and Water Watch, who actually commissioned an independent cost-benefit study for Los Angeles, which showed the true cost of the project being $9,000 per customer over time, really shows that if people heard those issues and we get it out to that level, then if nothing else is successful, then we are looking at an initiative process.
Well, and there's polling, right, by Joe Caves that has shown that the water bond itself, when you tell people the price tag, supposedly in his internal polls, is turning up in the 30s.
Oh, the big water bond, yeah. There's two others that we're looking at now, which are very different. But certainly 11.14 is way too heavy a Christmas tree.
And I'd like to add, there's also one other component about habitat conservation and paying for this project. You know, the BDCP calls for about a $4 billion commitment from the federal government towards habitat conservation. None of us can imagine with the way our Congress has been operating that they would be ecstatic to approve billions of dollars in a taxpayer plan to subsidize habitat conservation in California.
So you'll be on a press conference with Mitch McConnell in a year.
Most likely not. So I don't see any other questions in the queue. Again, star one. I want to thank all of our experts for giving their time. I want to thank all of you interested media and stakeholders for dialing in and listening. Again, our coalition is launching our campaign on Monday to defeat this boondoggle. This is a $50 billion project that will not solve our problem. We do challenge the governor to reconsider and please sit down and come up with a better solution that is sustainable, that is fair, and that is affordable and actually does meet the twin goals of restoring the Delta and providing a reliable and sustainable water supply plan. We do find it quite curious that the governor has demanded that any tax be placed before the vote of the people of California, and yet we, the people of California, will be paying all of this money, and yet he refuses to present it to the people. We will use education, we will use legislation, we will use litigation, and we will use the ballot. We do hope to convince the governor that there is a better solution. And that does conclude our call. Thank you very much. Again, on Monday, we will be at the state capitol. We will have a noontime rally. This will be advised to all of you. We will be in Santa Clara. We will be in Los Angeles. We have a statewide coalition of more than 50 organizations that will be voicing their strong opposition on Monday. That does conclude our call. Thank you very much. If you have any needs for information, follow-up interviews with our experts, or to know about our coalition's plans for next week, please contact me at 916-457-5546 or by email steve@hopcraft.com.